This week has seen more violence in Egypt as voters confront security forces and all sides in this struggle for freedom seem to grasp that there is no going back. But a year ago, we could scarcely have imagined where much of the Arab world would be headed in 2011.
We need dignity, freedom, liberty, okay?
Mohammed Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from the office of President of the Republic.
I've been waiting for this moment for many, many years. We are very, very thankful for every people who helped us in this revolution.
They love me, all my people with me. They love me all. They will die to protect me, my people.
A street vendor's act of desperation in Tunisia a year ago turns into a full-scale revolution across North Africa and became what will always be known as the Arab Spring. From Tunisia to Egypt to Libya to Syria, we've been following the movements of democracy as they spread this year from our studios in New York, and we've been talking to people on the ground, pundits, locals, reporters. And he's accustomed to being in the middle of things, but veteran BBC Middle East correspondent John Lyon was our companion for much of the turmoil this year. And his memories form a rich tapestry of history, of impressions, and frankly, for this hard-bitten old-school journalist, it's been a year of emotion, something even he had no inkling of a year ago.
No, not at all, in the sense that nobody predicted it. And funny enough, I was listening to Ala El Aswani, one of the most distinguished Egyptian writers who really is in tune with this country. And he was talking about January the 25th, and he said he fully expected a couple of hundred people to turn up then, as they did for every demonstration that we used to go to in the bad old days. And so he was surprised. We were all amazed to see this great explosion. On the other hand, I suppose that many people did know there was some sort of head of steam building up. The system here in Egypt and in so many other countries was so rotten and going so nowhere that something had to happen, but none of us really knew what or when would happen.
And certainly none of us would have predicted that Tunisia would be the nation to start it off. Describe the events that really transformed Tunisia first and then led the way to everything that happened since.
Well, of course, that started with this street vendor setting himself on fire and eventually dying as a result of his injuries. And that began a process, really, of breaking down this great dead wall of autocracies across the Middle East. And even before President Ben Ali of Tunisia resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia, I said even then, if he goes, that's going to open a huge chink in that great wall of autocracy, and who knows where it would lead. And of course, look where it has led.
In Tunisia, we also got the inklings of the importance of the digital world in all of this. Those pictures of Bouazizi making their way all around Tunisia were really part of the reason why the anger spread, don't you think?
Yes, it's been a means of communication. And yet I think it's been only that's the messenger, not the message. I think in many ways, that's been absolutely fascinating, seeing the way people have communicated on Facebook and by the internet. But of course, here in Egypt, for example, when the government really got into trouble, they just switched off the internet and they blocked all their mobile phones. So eventually, that was a means of communication. And it was key, of course, that it was that younger generation leading it. Here in Egypt, we saw that so much, leading the charge of the kind of vanguard of the revolution. But eventually, it was simply the popular anger that was mobilized and came out on the streets.
And certainly, the Mubarak government had no idea it would be perceived as such a provocative move to shut off the internet. Let's go back to Tahrir Square, a place that all the world knows now, but is certainly famous in Egypt. Why is Tahrir Square so significant, and why was it the place that people gathered?
Where the people gathered originally, actually, was just up the road from Tahrir Square, outside the law courts, which is where we used to have these very small demonstrations in the past, and we thought we were going to get another one. A couple of hundred people with many, many more police surrounding them, getting ready to beat them up and just beat them away. But on that day, it just took off. It took critical mass, and they sort of swarmed, really, to Tahrir Square from this location maybe half a mile away. And you saw this great moment when the police completely lost control of a situation, something they were just completely unused to happening here. They'd always known they could break up demonstrations in the past. And that gathered mass, literally, physically, on that moment, the people came in numbers to Tahrir Square. They gathered in Tahrir Square. The police regrouped, like an army, really. They regrouped, they lined themselves up, and then they attacked the demonstrators. But that was the moment the demonstrators didn't give way.
John Lyne, give me a picture of, and as you've described through so much of your reporting, it really what happened in Egypt is people decided, no, Tahrir Square is ours, it's not yours, referring to the authorities. And that's what unfolded on the video pictures that all of the world saw. What picture down on the street do you have of when you understood that that's what the transformation was?
I think two moments. First of all, literally that day on January the 25th, when the police simply couldn't repel the protesters. They kept charging them. I was literally sometimes in the middle between the protesters and the police as they threw rocks at each other and the tear gas came flying and the police kept charging with their sort of fearsome-looking riot gear on.
On the demonstrators, I was right amongst the police as they moved in with water cannon and batons.
So that was the first moment. And then there was a second moment, which was 3 days later. The government had had no idea how to respond. They just put more police out on the street. But the protesters came out in ever greater numbers on that Friday after Friday prayers. And they just broke the lines. Eventually, I was going back from one demonstration on one side of Cairo. And I was heading towards Tahrir Square myself. And I suddenly saw that everybody was just walking in one direction. They were all going to Tahrir Square, and there was nothing the security forces could do to stop them. And that was the evening, the night, when they then burnt down the headquarters of the ruling party, the NDP, and the army and the police, they didn't even send the fire engines. They let it burn. And that's the moment you knew that however long it took, the regime was finished.
John Lyne, BBC Middle East correspondent on the year 2011 in a region where he has spent his entire career. The end of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, though, was just one of the places where freedom and confrontation would change history. John Lyne will be back after a break.
So this is Libya, free Libya, as these people have it. It is completely free here of Colonel Gaddafi's forces.
Not huge numbers, maybe a few hundred, but very much a different spirit than we're used to here in Egypt, where demonstrations can be very small.
From the Syrian government, some grand theatre. A series of pro-government demonstrations, encouraged and choreographed by the authorities.
In the last few minutes, the police have moved in on the demonstrators, running battles now in the centre of Cairo. Bizarrely, one of the policemen, as he rushed to attack the protesters, said to me, "Excuse me," as he went past me.
We've been speaking with John Lyne, Middle East correspondent for our partner, the BBC, who's been taking us on a travelogue of history, revolution, and in some cases, violence. He's been following the democratic developments in Egypt and across North Africa and into the Middle East all year long. The wave of democratic yearnings hit Bahrain and Yemen. There were rumblings in Jordan and Syria. And as Lyne told us, the scenes he witnessed in those places and Egypt could not have been in sharper contrast to what he eventually found in Libya.
Well, I learned a lesson in Egypt that I keep repeating as a mantra, which is never underestimate the force of the opposition. They seem determined and will win out eventually. Now, in Libya, they faced a much more ruthless adversary, somebody, Colonel Gaddafi, willing to use really anything to stay in power. And I was first reporting from Libya from here in Cairo because we simply couldn't get in there. And the people there, we just have to keep reminding it, they took on a fully armed and trained military who were holding a fortress, a huge, great military base called Katiba in the middle of Benghazi, where the revolution really started there. And they ground down this military base and eventually it's destroyed. You go there now and the walls have been taken down. People still wander around inside it thinking, what have we done? How did we manage this? For years and years and years, Colonel Gaddafi, even back in the 70s when he'd faced no major threat, he just arrested some students and hung them from lampposts in the streets of Benghazi. And so you can imagine the fear they had to overcome. But once they'd overcome it, I guess the countervailing forces, once you've overcome that fear, there is no turning back. And there was no turning back for them from there.
We have heard of an attack today on Brega, which is not that far west of us here, which is an attack by Colonel Gaddafi's forces. They've retaken all or part of a big oil refinery complex there. And there was fears at one moment.
You know, we're so curious about your reporting and about so much of the reporting during this entire year is how distant the U.S. and the West was in all this. There were statements from presidents and there was talk of a U.S. initiative here and there. On the streets, did people talk about the great powers coming in and resetting the deck here, as was so much the case during the Cold War?
They did a little, but I think one of the big motifs of this year is the fact that this is not about America and this is not about great powers. So American power, we've almost seen melting away in the Middle East before our eyes. Mm. But there's still been an ambivalent attitude from Washington, and I think people here are beginning to sense that, that they actually, it kind of quite suits them to see the army still in quite a strong position of power in Egypt. They're a force for stability. They still support American policy broadly in the region, the peace treaty with Israel and so forth. So people here are ambivalent, but by and large, they're not really watching Washington so closely. I remember a second speech President Obama made to follow up from that groundbreaking one he made in Cairo at the beginning of his term, and people weren't watching. People weren't going to the cafes and watching the TVs. They just weren't listening anymore. Mm.
We last spoke to you in late November in Egypt, where you were covering the first parliamentary elections. There'd been a series of attacks and violence and further demonstrations in Tahrir Square.
Huge crowds yesterday, but still a steady stream of voters going to the polls here. So this time it's a little bit better organised, but I have also seen a lot of candidates distributing, or their representatives distributing their literature outside polling stations. That is technically illegal.
I'm wondering if in your voice by late November, I was beginning to detect some cynicism about this process in Egypt.
Well, not cynicism in the long term, but I was speaking with an artist just recently, and she had an exhibition on, and she called it The Waiting Room. And I think that's where a lot of people in Egypt understand we are. They've got rid of the old, but they haven't really formulated the new yet. And there's certainly a lot of forces of reaction there. The military don't quite know what to do. They clearly want to preserve their power and privileges to the extent that they can. And even to some extent, the new, in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamists, are actually part of the old order. So we're in a very unformulated new world here so far.
Finally, John Lyon, one of the things I admire most about you is you're real old school. You're detached. You have a sense of tell the story, get to the facts. But I'm wondering if at all during this year you felt more like a participant in history than an observer.
Oh, yes, it's been most exhilarating, not least because I've been around the Middle East for years and years. And frankly, covering Arab politics for years has been very depressing. The government's very unimaginative. And the people would just know they couldn't really speak openly, and you couldn't really get much out of people, ordinary people either. They just kind of trot out what they were supposed to say. And suddenly it has been a moment of absolute exhilaration. I think actually going to Libya was the most exhilarating, to see people just throwing off this years of quite horrendous tyranny, at times, frankly, supported by the West, even in Libya. And to see people just throwing that off, crazily sometimes. I mean, the recklessness of some of the fighters in Libya has been infuriating, actually. They haven't had any regard for their own safety. But by and large, to see people taking control of their own destiny, I'm convinced, however worried you may be about who may take power in the short term, whether it's Islamist or extremist or whatever, I am convinced that in the long term, a Middle East with the people deciding their own futures has got to be good for not just for the Middle East, but for the world.
A real Magna Carta year for you, huh?
I'm convinced this year is quite as important in Middle East history as anything we've seen for 100 years. It is a complete reshaping. And this is a region with so much potential. It's so close to Europe. It's got so many resources. In many countries, you've got very many very well-educated people. Tunisia already is beginning to sort itself out because it's so well-positioned. You can get from Tunisia by boat to Europe in only just over 24 hours. So the potential for industry, for tourism, for culture is absolutely is breathtaking.
Well, John Lyon, have a great 2012. John Lyon, Middle East correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.